Hi, and welcome to the Final Cut, RN's weekly look at film and screen. I'm Jason DeRosso. This week on the show, Chilean director Pablo Larraín will be discussing his dreamy detective thriller, Neruda, about the poet Pablo Neruda. I'll be reviewing the Australian thriller, Hounds of Love, plus American critic and one third of the Slate Culture Gabfest, Dana Stevens will be in. But first, the big film this week is Wonder Woman. I couldn't get along to this screening, so I sent guest critic Serena Masukor, a film curator, writer, and lecturer in film at the University of Technology in Sydney.
What is this place? Who are you people?
We are the bridge to a greater understanding.
Right.
What is your mission?
Well, here's the thing. You are in more danger than you think. The boys in the trenches called her Dr. Poison. Millions would die. The war would never end.
I'm going, Mother. If you choose to leave, you may never return. Who will I be if I stay?
This week, the long-awaited Wonder Woman film hits our screens, featuring Gal Gadot as Diana, the powerful Amazon princess who enters the human world to end war. Directed by Patty Jenkins, who previously directed the 2003 Oscar-winning Monster, Wonder Woman starts full of energy and fun, but ends with a bit of a disappointing climax. This is an origin story, and it introduces a Wonder Woman with the potential to develop in all kinds of radical ways. After all, she's a character with a radical history. Born of a period in feminism where women were beginning to fight for reproductive rights and sexual freedom, one of the inspirations for Wonder Woman was the activist Margaret Sanger, who co-founded America's first birth control clinic. And Wonder Woman's creator, the psychologist William Moulton Marston, lived in a polyamorous relationship with two highly educated feminists, an arrangement that feels very contemporary. When Wonder Woman first appeared in 1941, she was to be an example of an athletic, brave, and intelligent woman who excelled in areas that were then, and often still are, dominated by men. She was also sexual. Her whip comes straight from the bondage pin-ups that were popular at the time, as does her originally hypercharged physique. Not everyone will agree with Wonder Woman's retro fantasy appearance as an image of empowered sexuality, but the idea that a woman can be strong and smart and enjoy sex openly remains a pretty radical one. Jenkins' film, of course, is child-friendly. There's no sex and very little banter, but she does set up the conditions for Wonder Woman to develop in more adult directions as the franchise grows.
Diana. Fighting does not make you a hero.
What if I promise to be careful? Just a shield then.
Diana.
We meet Diana as she's growing up on the island of Themyscira.
Be careful of mankind, Diana.
A lush paradise inhabited exclusively by Amazons. Diana is headstrong and determined. Defying her mother, the Queen Hippolyte, played with warmth by Connie Nielsen, and sneaking out to learn combat techniques from her aunt, General Antiope, a fierce Robin Wright.
Never let your guard down. You expect a battle to be fair. A battle will never be fair.
This first act is fun. The acrobatics of the women training for battle fill the screen with motion and energy.
Harder. You're stronger than this, Diana.
And with no men in sight, the place is harmonious. When the women disagree, as Hippolyte and Antiope do over training Diana, they work out their differences in ways that are rational and fair. It's not unlike some of the respectful, supportive female communities I know. Only everyone is stunningly good-looking, adept at archery and hand-to-hand combat, and multilingual, speaking an absurd amount of languages, including Ottoman and ancient Greek. When the Allied spy Steve Taylor tumbles into Themyscira's waters, Diana decides she must leave the island and go with him into the depths of the First World War. Her rationale? Ares, god of war, is behind the chaos, and it is her role to stop him. Once in the world of men, the tone shifts dramatically. This is done quite beautifully through colour. Stylistically, this London set part of the film feels more like a war drama than a comic book genre film. I was reminded of things like Atonement and Testament of Youth, And Diana, when she speaks up in rooms of men, is more like a smart young woman than a god. The tone shifts again when Diana and Steve journey to the front, where Diana becomes Wonder Woman, single-handedly taking on the full force of the German army.
What are you?
You will soon find out.
You are still no match for me.
We'll see about that.
Disappointingly, there are only two woefully underwritten supporting female characters in this part of the story. Etta Candy, the enthusiastic Lucy Davis, who stays in London while the others go to the front, and the villain Dr. Poison, a cool Elena Anaya, a pawn of Ares whom we learn little about. It's this lack of quality villains that makes the ending drag. When Ares finally appears, it's David Thewlis, so lacking in charisma that it's difficult to believe he's Diana's brother. I get the joke that the god of war would be an old white man, but I like villains to be just a tiny bit more cunning than the heroes, to give them something to really go up against. Running at over 2 hours, the film is long and the battles of the final act lack the vigour of the early battle on the beach. They're too much brawn and not quite enough guile. But Gal Gadot is a terrific embodiment of Wonder Woman. She's energetic and warm, and when she's given a funny line, she delivers it sharply. I look forward to seeing where Hollywood takes Wonder Woman next. I wouldn't mind seeing her work with a team of smart human women, facing a more seductive version of evil, and perhaps developing a darker side.
You didn't stand your ground, you didn't fight.
Because there was no chance of changing his mind.
This is Ares, and he's not going to allow a negotiation or a surrender.
Wonder Woman is out everywhere now.
Guest critic Sarita Masukor. You're listening to The Final Cut on RN.
Han pasado solo 3 años desde el fin de la Segunda Guerra Mundial y aquí está a punto de empezar una persecución fabulosa.
¿Cómo me veo?
Irreconocible.
Con ustedes, el poeta Pablo Neruda.
Puedo escribir los versos más tristes esta noche.
Last week, I spoke briefly about the new film Neruda by Chilean director Pablo Larraín. He's the director whose film you might remember from a few years back, Tony Manero. That was an oddball allegory of post-dictatorship paranoia in Chile about a Saturday Night Fever John Travolta impersonator, who was also something of a psychopath. Well, since then, Larraín's made his first film in English, the Oscar-nominated Jackie, starring Natalie Portman. But the unhealed wounds of Chilean history remain key inspirations for him. Neruda is about legendary poet and one-time communist senator Pablo Neruda and his flight from Chile at the beginning of the Cold War to escape anti-leftist purges. But Larraín doesn't tell this story straight. Working off a baroque and hallucinatory script by Guillermo Calderón, he hands the film's narration to a fascist detective played by Gael Garcia Bernal. This film noir-inspired antagonist is in fact a figment of Neruda's poetic imagination, an adversary who represents everything the poet fears and detests: pettiness, vindictiveness, hierarchy. But if the detective doesn't technically exist, Garcia Bernal and Larraín make him every bit the flesh-and-blood villain on screen. Certainly, there were men like him, and what he symbolises is what's so terrifying. As a fugitive, meanwhile, Neruda responds with humour, taunting his adversary by leaving a trail of detective novels and making appearances in broad daylight, disguised as a priest, and on one occasion, a prostitute. Luis Gnecco is really well cast to bring a melancholic and playful inflection to this paradoxically aristocratic communist. He's especially good at showing there's a heavy price to pay too, even if his character does escape this nightmare. I spoke to Larraín down a fuzzy phone line from Chile to find out more. I wasn't surprised when he cited Borges as an influence.
There's an Argentinian writer called Jorge Luis Borges, who some of his most known work, it's around characters that are creating things into the same story. Not just other characters, but sometimes stories and situations, no? And that also, I guess, it's wonderful. It's one of the tools of narrative, and specifically in this case of cinema, where one character is able to create another one in order to exist. because that first character, the creator, is someone who needs to explain his own existence through the reality of another one. And then what happens is that the second one, the one that is created, ultimately become a mirror for both and a necessity also. So I guess that metafiction, it's an act of love, basically, because the character that Gael Garcia plays, ultimately at some point when he realized that has been created what he needs and he's screaming out to the world, it's somebody that takes care of him. And I guess the fact that Neruda created him, it's an act of love. I guess it also talks about the mission of art somehow, where an artist is creating a character because he needs to express his own love, and also he needs to understand his own existence throughout his own creation.
I'm struck by how so many of your films deal with the notion of image and the idea of telling a story, but also deal with the way that power tries to tell stories. I mean, I'm thinking of Jackie, but I'm thinking of also your early films, which were very sort of allegorical reflections on Chile and on its past with the dictatorship and so forth. I'm thinking of Tony Manero, for example, or Postmortem.
In the case of Jackie and Neruda and others, it's people that were at some point able to shape their own public image, or they tried this and they worked on it. And there's always a gap in between the intention and the result. And that gap is the door for our fiction, where you can get in and work with those materials.
Very interesting, because Neruda, of course, was born poor, but then entered into this sort of aristocratic world. And in some ways, you even point out that he liked it to some degree. So there's that. I love that paradox. It's quite interesting.
And it's a huge contradiction that I guess we all somehow have. And of course, cinema is made out of contradiction. If you have no paradox, then there's no cinema.
Director Pablo Larraín talking on the phone from Chile. And apologies again for that phone line. His film, Neruda, is out now. It is one of the best things that's released so far this year. Go see it.
Hey, love. Do you want a lift?
You're going to write a letter to your parents. Say that you've met a bloke and he's got you a ticket to Adelaide.
We see kids run off like this every day.
You think she's prettier than me?
Look at me.
He doesn't love you.
You lie.
He just uses you.
We usually do it together. There's just something about you that makes me want you all to myself.
Now let's go in there and have a little bit of fun.
There are two new Australian films out this week, one in cinemas, the other on Netflix. First to the cinematic release, Hounds of Love is a thriller from first-time writer-director Ben Young, which is loosely inspired by a Perth couple in the 1980s, I remember this, who kidnapped, raped and killed several young women. Compared to the Larraín film, Hounds of Love is a conventional white-knuckle ride. It's about a girl who falls into this couple's clutches and endures days of hell. The setting, 1980s Perth, is a time and place which, as someone who lived through it, was buzzing with flashy millionaires and their glass skyscrapers. But Young has made the film in the brick and tile suburban margins. You'd expect him to be making some kind of statement, a bit like Justin Kurzel did with Snowtown, about neglected, dysfunctional communities. But he's more interested in asking broader psychological questions, with the 80s a not particularly well-remembered, slightly kitsch framing device. What makes a woman help a man kill other women? A red raw performance from Emma Booth fleshes out a textbook psychological analysis about feminine low self-esteem and manipulative silver-tongued male psychopaths. Opposite her, Stephen Curry almost but doesn't quite shed his comedian's instinct for caricature as a neat freak, Aussie battler and brutal killer. Hounds of Love premiered at a sidebar competition at the Venice Film Festival, and it launched Ben Young into that club of Australian filmmakers Greg McLean, Justin Kurzel, David Michaud, whose knack with extreme characters and brutal violence has garnered them critical admiration. It's true that Ben Young has talent. An early scene where the couple's victim, played by Ashley Cummings, staggers around their lounge room after drinking a spiked drink, realizing suddenly she's been trapped but unable to fight her way out as the drug takes effect, is one of three or four very strong sequences that hold you in this nightmare. I liked his extreme slow motion shots of suburban streets too, taken as if from a prowling car, and the way that they work as a metaphor of these predators operating in plain sight. Their unassuming Anglo-Aussie appearance is a perfect disguise. They may as well be like faster-than-light evil spirits lurking in between the ticks of a clock, too quick for their slow-motion victims to spot them. But why are Australian directors, and you can add to this list Kate Shortland, whose latest film, Berlin Syndrome, dealt with a similar story, attracted to such vile inhumanity? You could argue there's a brutal violence that's repressed deep inside us as a people that somehow needs to come out on screen. But at the end of Hounds of Love, and its not unexpected moment of female redemption, I didn't feel like the ordeal was particularly cathartic or revelatory. Meanwhile, Animal Kingdom director David Michaud has a new film, War Machine, made for Netflix and released just last month. Expanding his style to satire with this piece that he's written and directed, it's a fall from grace story, inspired by the American Afghan War General Stanley McChrystal, who was forced to resign after a profile piece in Rolling Stone revealed him criticising the Obama presidency. Brad Pitt is jarring in the film, pitching his performance way too over the top with quirky mannerisms. But every so often, War Machine finds a sweet spot as a tragedy about an unwinnable war and a career general who can't shake his commitment to the cause.
Well, Mr. President, I think our government simply felt it was time our effort took a new direction.
And what is this new direction?
It's most important to me that we build Afghanistan. Together, we build Afghanistan into a free and prosperous nation, free from fear and conflict.
I see.
No.
I see. Sounds a lot like the old direction.
It's a slick, well-made production with a great cast, including Ben Kingsley as a comically disinterested Hamid Karzai. But the farcical tone does tend to undermine the pathos and puts the film more in the vein of Entourage than Apocalypse Now. War Machine is on Netflix. And Netflix is what leads me to my final guest. The streaming service has been in the news lately, putting noses out of joint at the just-concluded Cannes Film Festival by declaring that its two competition films will be skipping a conventional cinema release and heading straight to the small screen. Noah Baumbach's The Meyerowitz Story, starring Dustin Hoffman, and Bong Joon-ho's Okja, starring Tilda Swinton, which is the closing night film at the Sydney Film Festival. So, Netflix was very much on my mind when I sat down to speak with the well-known American critic, Dana Stevens from Slate, who was in the country for the Sydney Writers Festival this last week, along with her two co-hosts from Slate's Culture Gabfest podcast. Another thing on my mind was the state of American cinema, given that Cannes had also hosted well-received new films by New York Safdie brothers and Sofia Coppola. We didn't know when we recorded this interview that Coppola would go on to win the Best Director, only the second time a woman has ever done so. But certainly her film The Beguiled and the Safdie brothers' Good Time were both getting good reactions. So I began by asking Dana about the state of American film and the rise of Netflix.
I mean, I think this is not only the case in America. Maybe it's extremely acute there because it's such a center of the world film industry, but it seems like that division between, you know, what's thought of as these niche, you know, art house creations and the big churning industry of Hollywood that keeps it all afloat is becoming broader and broader in a way that is outside of the big urban centers in the U.S. is pretty disturbing, because it will be really hard for quite some time for people to get their hands on Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled or the new Safdie brothers film. And it used to be the case that there was this mid-level, you know, American movie that was something, I'm trying to think of something that would be an example of this. I mean, a movie that wasn't purely niche art house, but that was also not a tentpole blockbuster, that was just a mid-level good movie. And those kind of movies seem to be getting squeezed out of the marketplace entirely, especially because the industry is going global and every movie needs to please every culture, you know, and so we have all these identical blockbusters coming out every year that feel more and more to me like they're specially engineered so that the Chinese market will buy them and, you know, the European market will understand them. And it's,
I'm sure it's why action travels so well too, right? Because it's kind of more kinetic and kind of visual and universal, right, than something that's sort of dialogue heavy. But it has, you know, has all that more sort of dialogue heavy stuff, the stuff dealing with kind of quote unquote adult themes, just sort of migrated to TV? Or is that not quite quite the same thing as TV, you know, prestige TV, not quite doing the same thing that middle ground cinema used to do?
I mean, I hope it's not. I, as a cinephile, I mean, someone who also enjoys a lot of the great television that's coming out now, but really at heart a cinephile, I don't like this idea, more of a rhetorical idea really than I think anything that's affecting the film industry, but this statement that you hear over and over that TV is the new film, or something that the Game of Thrones creator said about I'm making a 73-hour movie. Yeah, I mean, that is just meaningless, right? I mean, once you've made that statement, then you're just sort of saying that anything that's projected on a rectangular screen is a movie. And that form of serial storytelling that TV engages in, while it's really valuable and is doing all kinds of innovative things recently, is just not the same thing, both for communitarian reasons, right? I mean, just going to a theater and watching a movie projected, I think, still has value. And I think a lot of audiences still think that it has value. And also, of course, the format of telling a completed story in, you know, not necessarily 2 hours, some could be many variations, but in a set period of time that is spent in the company of others watching it. That, to me, is still, although it has been around since the early 20th century, is still a meaningful cultural experience that's distinct and that I think deserves to be preserved.
Are young people in America, do you get a sense that young people in America, though, are still aspiring to make films, that we've still got those kind of cinephiles who want to make films and we'll make them by hook or by crook? I mean, I guess I'm thinking of people like the Safdies, but Sean Baker, and there are those that are around, but the impression you always have is that there are less than there were in previous generations. I don't know. What's your opinion?
I mean, there certainly are still, I think, people of even the millennial generation, even younger than the Safdie brothers, but who want to make them. The question is, are there enough young people who want to see them, you know, and who will keep that industry alive by actually paying for the space to go and watch one? And that's something that's shifting so fast that I have no prognostications about it, but I think it's the film industry should be very worried about it and trying to solve that problem any way they can.
Where do you, I mean, as a film critic, and you're still called a film critic at Slate, right? That's your title.
You're as opposed a film to critic. A movie a, critic?
No, a film movie. No, as opposed to, I don't know, a critic of screen or,
right?
I mean, where do you sit in terms of your remit now that there is so much more kind of interesting and certainly, you know, things that are worthy of critical analysis on the smaller screen or, you know, in spaces like Netflix and so forth? Are you still essentially bound by a sort of bricks and mortar theatrical release?
That's a great question. Well, Slate does have a TV critic as well. So there's a certain amount of, you know, jurisdiction that we respect. Like, I'm not going to review the new Twin Peaks, even though it's a David Lynch joint, because it's a TV show.
That's interesting, though.
Right. I mean, and there may start to be more crossover in between those two as, for example, more films are released directly to Netflix or other such services and never get any theatrical projection at all. And recently on the podcast I do for Slate, the Slate Culture Gabfest, we had as a guest a young director whose second movie had been a big hit at a festival. I don't remember if it was Sundance or South by Southwest, but he had, you know, won a prize and done really well. And presumably there was going to be the traditional bidding war over who was going to get to distribute his movie. And he ended up making a deal with Netflix, even though he had other theatrical offers. Netflix just made him a better offer, and he believed that more people would see his movie that way, so he chose it. And that, for example, is that a TV show or is that a movie? Probably the TV critic and I would have to, you know,
juke it out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, basically we would have to each make our case to the editor as to who was going to write about that and what form of thing it was.
Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. And you can hear more of Dana, of course, on the Slate Culture Gabfest. Before I go, a mention of two other ABC initiatives that are definitely worth a look if you're interested in film. The first on the TV, the three-part series David Stratton's Stories of Australian Cinema begins next Tuesday night on ABC One at 8:30. The other project is a podcast about race and identity in Australia called It's Not a Race. Episode 2 is all about Charles Chauvel's classic problematic film, about Indigenous repression and cultural denial called Jeddah, featuring a brief appearance from me. The whole series is hosted and produced by Beverly Wang and rolls out over the next few weeks. It's Not a Race, a very timely and thoughtful podcast series from the ABC. I'm Jason DeRosso. Our time is up. Join me again on The Final Cut next week.
I'm Beverly Wang, and do you ever think about race, like these guys?
There's a reluctance and a reticence for people to grapple with it. Sometimes you want to turn away from it, pretend it doesn't exist, and sometimes you want to exaggerate it.
I had this guy come up to me in a bar and, like, stroke my skin, and he couldn't speak English, like he was French-speaking, but all he was saying was, café latte, café latte.
It's Not a Race, the podcast Australia needs right now. Find it wherever you get your podcasts, or tap Explore and listen via the ABC Radio app.